Now, before episode 3 of TV Cream Countdown, the 50 greatest Doctor Who moments, a message from Cyberman Bates.
Whenever you download a podcast, you need to be sure that the podcast you choose is suitable for the audience at home. To help you, there are certificates given to podcasts that tell you broadly what the podcast is like. Here is a brief edited selection of the podcast to follow. Engage trailer.
If we can hitch a ride in on one of those three-dimensional geometric shapes from the Wogan title sequence, we might just make it.
Very much a Jobsworth. You can't park there, sir. It's called Jobsworth.
They're searching for the place where Doctor Who producer John Nathan Turner.
My name is Debbie Flynn, and I'm a QVC presenter, and we work out of the studios in Chiswick. And I've just come off doing an hour of Women with Control shape pants. I'm just about to go back on to do an hour of Fashion for Women.
This podcast has been classified as 3.5 tortoises out of 5 on Russell's Ratometer, which means it is unsuitable for anyone who is a new series fan only. Podcasts rated 3.5 tortoises have a fairly adult theme or contain scenes pertaining to BBV video spin-offs, chat about BBC scheduling, and the human designated John Nathan Turner. They may also contain sexual swear words, or to be more precise, sound clips from Torchwood. Podcast certification is there to allow you to make an informed choice. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the podcast. Warning terminated.
Good and important work, Cyberman Bates. And here we go again. At number 30, the Doctor Who office.
Go searching for the place where Doctor Who producer John Nathan Turner used to get sucked off while on the phone to Blue Peter editor Biddy Baxter, and you'll find a room wiped clean of all seepage, anatomical or otherwise. For if the old Doctor Who office ever really counted for anything, it was as a temporary repository for schemes, fancies, fluids, and careers. All of them have now gone, but we shouldn't be surprised. By the 1980s, Doctor Who wasn't interested in anything permanent. It had become an industry of fleeting pleasures, run from a place increasingly possessed of a purpose only in the minds of others. The office had always been held in lofty regard by the show's followers. The trouble began only when its occupants started to believe it too. But if fans had known their script submissions weren't being perused in detail by some latter-day Pericles, but instead sat on tables under which victims hid from a latter-day Caligula, would they have turned away, repulsed? Probably not. If the myth had been felled, like the Hydra, another two would have sprung up to take its place. For by the 1980s, the show was fated almost wholly by those who believed it owed them one of three things: a living, a blowjob, or a pension. At least one of these was available on tap. The office had passed from being the least presumptuous to the most preposterous dab of colour on the Doctor Who palette. Not even the good ship Blue Peter pulled rank over this particular tumescence. A figurative roll of police tape encircles this chunk of Doctor Who history, where once spun a web of cheer. And thank goodness, whatever totemic worth the office once commanded has long ago perished. those stacks of signed photographs probably never really existed. What detritus remained after the show's cancellation sat in boxes destined for incineration. One slice of Doctor Who mythology nobody criticised the BBC for erasing. As for John Nathan Turner's telephone, that was buried in the same place as the episodes of Have I Got News For You, where Paul Merton calls Princess Diana an overblown tart.
Number 29. The Master Debate.
Peoples of the universe, please attend carefully. The message that follows is vital to the future of you all. The choice for you all is simple. A continued existence under my guidance, or total annihilation. I truly am the best master. No, you're not. It is widely accepted that I am the best master. Nonsense. I only need two things. Your submission and your obedience to my will. You see? I knew this was going to be difficult, but I didn't think that even you would be so stupid as to make it impossible. I beg your pardon? That's the quote, dear heart, from the Five Doctors, in which I was magnificent. Nonsense! The demons, now, that was the story. To do my will shall be the whole of the law. Now that's class. Not as classy as my outfit. Look at the quality of the stitching on that collar. My outfit is infinitely more impressive. Sleek, sinister, minimalist. It makes you look like a Bond villain. Better than a pantomime villain. I'm the best. No, I am the best. I'm better. Not. Am. Not. Am.
I am the master.
Oh, piss off.
Number 28. Here's a particularly stupid theory.
Did you ever think you'd become this? The man who can turn an army around at the mention of his name.
As every good man who goes to war will tell you, sometimes what the Doctor's going to do in the future has already been determined long ago in the past.
Here's a particularly stupid theory,
wrote Stephen Moffat in 1995. This was a message on Rekart 2, the Gallifrey base of its day, and the early internet forum, where Doctor Who superfans could gather, chat, and keep one eye looking over the other person's shoulder, just in case someone of greater influence came into the room. Somebody that I used to know. Anyway, back to Moffat.
If we take the Doctor to be the Doctor's name, even if it is in the form of a title, no doubt meaning something deep and Gallifreyan, perhaps our earthly use of the word Doctor, meaning healer or wise man, is a direct result of the Doctor's multiple interventions in our history as a healer and wise man. In other words, we got it from him. This is a very silly idea, and I'm consequently rather proud of it.
So proud, in fact, that this little thought resurfaced in 2011's A Good Man Goes to War.
Doctor, the word for healer and wise man throughout the universe. We get that word from you, you know. But if you carry on the way you are, what might that word come to mean?
And not in any major way, not as a plot point, which would suggest that Moffat had dragged the notion deep from his brain to solve a thorny storyline issue, but as a bit of thematic colour, which leads us to conclude the Who showrunner had always really liked this very silly idea and had had it buzzing around his head constantly for 15 years or so. Stephen Moffat is by no means the only Who luminary to have expressed their opinions about the show prior to getting tangled up in it. We know, thanks to Zoe Ball, that Peter Capaldi once wrote to the Radio Times in praise of what have only recently become his predecessors. But that was no means his only adventure into printed Who-mongery. In 1976, the youthful Peter wrote a very grown-up piece for the Doctor Who International Fan Club magazine, praising Bernard Lodge's title sequences.
Watching the abstracted light forms and patterns which appear in the opening sequence of Doctor Who has become a familiar ritual to all of us,
he wrote. Familiar, yes, but few other DWIFC writers will ever experience the feeling of seeing those abstracted light forms and patterns coalesce round their very own rapidly enlarging head. Incidentally, points off to the incoming Doctor here for the sloppy use of the DR shorthand when writing the word Doctor, but extra points for his lovely drawing of a Sea Devil, which featured in another Fanny Enterprise. Then there's Dalek Operator, Whovian Wag and Pantomime Expert Nicholas Pegg, who sent off a letter to the official Doctor Who magazine only to have it printed in issue 55 and misattributed to one Nicholas Peggy.
Bollocks!
Which is the second most embarrassing thing about that letter. And if that's the second most embarrassing thing about that letter, you'll be asking yourself, what's the third? Peggy's effusive praise for fellow DWM letter writer Matthew Adric Waterhouse. That's what.
And it was a big launch here in Manchester.
Now, we started this look back at Luminary's pre-Who opinionating with the electronic correspondence of showrunner Stephen Moffat. So, let's finish off with his predecessor.
Marvellous.
Russell T Davies' fondness for Doctor Who was well known for years before he brought the series back. Not least due to his penmanship of the 1996 Who novel Damaged Goods and his popular Channel 4 drama Queer as Folk, which was rammed right up to the cannon wheels with gratuitous whoiness.
Blah, 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 blah.
However, Russell's associated online presence is less prolific, which is not to say that he never committed fingerstroke to message board. Back at the turn of the century, T. Davies did contribute a few posts to an online community for Doctor Who superfans known as the Stonecutters. Although very few of his postings focus on Whovenalia, on the 25th of February 2000, at the end of a longish missive about car theft, he did post the following update, which shines a light on the less than mercurial speed of the BBC.
No Doctor Who news, by the way. One email every 6 months from the BBC is like lightning for them.
So sadly then, no early insights have been uncovered as to when the idea to have fat aliens who do smells from their bums first popped into Russell's head.
Oh, excuse me.
What's going on here?
Or when he deduced that autons should take on the form of dustbins that eat people and then burp. Perhaps some ideas just come out smelling of bodily emissions without ever having to have been previously digested.
Number 27. But first, this.
Sometimes you just have to look at modern day Doctor Who fans with their DVDs and their featurettes and their confidential and their spin-off series and their ebooks and their smartphone games and their character options limited editions and their coffee mugs, their dinner jackets and their submarines and conclude that they just don't know that they're born. Back in the late 80s, loyal few who'd stuck with the Doctor through thick and thin tended to regard any bit of inter-season extracurricular promotion was the most exciting thing that had happened all year, so much so that when there were a grand total of 3 mentions of the show in the Radio Times over the summer of 1988, this was interpreted as hope that the series was about to embark on a massive upwards ratings trajectory and finally see off Coronation Street for good. Well, we had to make our own entertainment in those days. One of the most fondly remembered of these actually came over the summer of 1987, when little-remembered children's BBC summer holiday morning magazine show But First This, happily in its pre-Esther McVeigh incarnation, but the less we say about her the better, went behind the scenes of the location filming for forthcoming new Sylvester McCoy story, Delta and the Bannermen. In addition to a glimpse of the technical wizardry that went into filming the Tollport G715 scenes, excited and excitable viewers were also treated to a handful of interviews with the cast. During these, we learned that Sylvester McCoy used to watch Star Trek and used to write letters to the Rock that they were setting the scenery or something where nobody's quite sure what he was on about, and that Ken Dodd's motivation was that his character was very much a Jobsworth. You can't park there, sir, it's more than my Jobsworth. True, in real terms we learned absolutely nothing about anything at all whatsoever, not even about that Rock, but it was just about the nearest thing to a DVD extra that you actually got in those days, and was watched and rewatched probably more times than the actual story itself. That's worth remembering the next time that you're being asked to pay monastic reverence to Arthur Darvill explaining green screen for the 840th time.
Number 26. Fan Wank.
So what were we meant to do when this happened?
There are worlds out there where the sky's burning, where the seas asleep and the rivers dream. People made of smoke and cities made of song. Some of there's danger, some of there's injustice. Somewhere else the tea's getting cold. Come on, Ace, we've got work to do.
Were we meant to slake our insatiable thirst for sci-fi with the likes of this?
Are you alive?
Yes.
Or this?
My name is John Crichton, an astronaut. Radiation wave hit, and I got shot through a wormhole.
Lost in some distant part of the universe on a ship, a living ship.
Stuff like this helped.
Oh boy!
Interminable shit like this didn't.
I'm an annoyance to my superiors, a joke to my peers. They call me Spooky. Spooky Mulder.
Not even this bad boy could keep us going.
It was the dawn of the third age of mankind. 10 years after the Earth-Minbari War, the Babylon Project was a dream given form.
There was this sort of thing.
Once again, it's time for Pigs in Space. Deep Dish 9, the next generation of Pigs in Space!
Well, sort of. But by the time we got to Deeply Improbable Dish 9, we were heavily into the wrong kind of sci-fi. We knew what we wanted. We wanted this.
Planet Earth, 1999. He's back, and it's about time.
Who are you?
I am the Doctor!
Well, as it turns out, not quite that. But it did this for a while. But what really, really mattered was this.
Robin.
I'm the Doctor, by the way. What's your name?
Rose.
Nice to meet you, Rose. Run for your life.
The Doctor is a legend woven throughout history. When disaster comes, he's there. He brings the storm in his wake. And he has one constant companion.
Who's that?
Death.
You could stay here, fill your life with work and food and sleep, or you could go where... Anywhere.
Is it always this dangerous?
Yeah.
Do you remember? Do you remember the sheer excitement of it all? Perhaps it was that excitement which spawned a whole new universe of fanwank. A perfect storm of rabid hooligans slavering at the mouth for something fresh to pore over, no longer confined to discussing the feasibility of mandrels.
You're not Doctor Who, are you? What have you done with him? What have you done with Doctor Who? And who are you? You're a mandrel, aren't you? I know you anywhere.
And the superlative medium of the internet as a carrier. Of course, it wasn't long before things went too far. Old school diehard fans quickly developed, that is to say about 5 minutes into Rose, a frenzy of hatred for the mundanes who had jumped on the bandwagon only 42 years too late, and any reference to Eccles as the first Doctor or his outing as a new series was enough to encourage aneurysm in those who cared too much. This reached its apogee with one line from Parting of the Ways, the concluding episode.
They survived through me.
Since that line was in the trail the previous week, we got a full 7 days of speculation, postulation, hyperbole, and full-on copper-bottom bollocks. So who was the voice?
Who is it?
Who is it?
It's me.
Nope. It was, of course.
This is the Emperor of the Daleks.
It was almost a disappointment that it wasn't, in fact, any of the demented suggestions that were flying around the message boards and forums. Suggestions that ranged everywhere from the Black Guardian to Fenric.
Where is the game? Time Lord.
Really? Fenric? And it mattered not a jot that the chances of either of those being correct were negligible, shall we say, especially since we'd just had the big Dalek reveal a few moments before.
The Doctor is initiating hostile action!
Bastard, you bastard, Vance!
nothing was going to stand in the way of the relentless rise of pointless, deluded fanwine. And what other programme but Doctor Who has ever inspired so much navel-gazing introspection and pointlessly detailed study?
Hey, Commander, as I was saying, in the Quasar Dilemma, remember you used the auxiliary of Deck B for... Could you get Deck B for Gamma Override? The thing is that online blueprints clearly indicate that Deck B is independent of the Guidance Matrix. So we were wondering just where the error lies in that.
It's just a television show, that's all, okay?
Oh, well, we're beyond parody here. And by the way, Doctor Who is not just a show, unlike so many latter-day interlopers.
Useless. Nul point.
But bad thing? Maybe not. For this is the sort of stuff that led to the return of Doctor Who in the first place. So is it a price worth paying for a cosmos of nonsense? Well, yes.
Number 25. More like the swear zone solution.
But now the weather with Arnie Davis.
Thank you very much, Quentin. I'm glad to see the acne's better.
In 1993, Doctor Who's 30th anniversary was honoured in a number of special ways, including the fun and laughs of seeing Adrian Wrigglesford's dreams of writing a multi-Doctor story, the aborted The Dark Dimension, being stolen away from him like, well, like so many photographs from Associated Newspapers archives. Plus, there was also the thrill of John Nathan Turner sporting his oversized 3D glasses on Tomorrow's World.
These are the executive model. They're called producer's perks.
But the finest moment from that year was a very special one-off straight-to-video drama in which Doctor Who actors wore their own clothes and ate big packets of gourmet crisps in Bill Bagg's house. This was the Air Zone Solution.
Toxic levels, I'm afraid, combined with ozone depletion, which means you're going to get rather...
Written by a pre-ring modulated Nicholas Briggs and directed by Bill Bilbo the Bastard Baggins Bags, the Air Zone Solution was an eco-thriller, fictionally unconnected to Doctor Who, but very firmly tethered to the mothership by virtue of its cast, which included Colin Baker...
Shall we dance?
John Pertwee...
Quite a youthful conversation, I imagine. With the other fella...
Peter Davison...
Oh, God... Oh, my God.
Sylvester McCoy.
9:29 p.m. That's when it first happened. 9:29 p.m.
Nicola Bryant. Colin played weatherman Arnie Davis, who falls in with a radical environmentalist group and uncovers the naughty goings-on of the Air Zone Corporation. They're developing something nasty to combat air pollution. Shot on unforgivably grey videotape, it's the kind of drama where the highlights Alan Cumming sports slick back hair and conducts phone conversations full of preposterously pretentious one-liners such as...
Spent forces.
Yeah. The Air Zone Solution could perhaps be likened to The Edge of Darkness being performed as the Generation Games end-of-show play, but actually back in the early 90s it seemed quite gritty, even nuanced.
Marketing and public perception. It's not the idea. Neat idea. Bad image.
Less so now. But something that still thrills two decades on is the chance to witness Doctor Who actors swearing. It begins with this.
Have a shit skirt.
Peter, steady. Then it ramps up to...
Piss off!
Oh, Nicola, do you kiss Nev Fountain with that mouth? Anyway, back to Peter again.
Official bullshit from the government!
And then Sylvester McCoy, who really takes the curse out of Fenric.
Bollocks is an old chap!
You did good, Professor. Now, if reading the Bucks Free Press has taught us anything, other than the Dashwood Arms pub in Piddington has really, really got to sort out those kitchens, it's that Colin Baker has always been the most eloquent incarnation of TV's favourite Time Lord. And so there's no profanity from our man of sagacity. Instead, all sexy turns all sexy. Be glad you're not watching this. That's Doctor Who Colin Baker humping Doctor Who companion Nicola Bryant. Oh, Colin, get off her. What are you messing with down there?
That is a Contron tunnel. Put more colloquially, it's a time corridor in space.
To be honest, it's actually pretty mild and cuts away before the real rumpo gets going. Thankfully, this isn't the full frontal boob fest of something like Zygon, when Being You Just Isn't Enough, a later release from director Bill Baggs, which engorged Doctor Who forum threads in 2008.
For another three, Bob, I'll show you my Scarison.
Nonetheless, the implication that the Doctor has just performed the old bigger on the inside routine on Perry unsettles to this day. Sure, there is something in the notion of using Doctor Who as a springboard into more mature drama, but as that man said,
neat idea, bad image.
Number 24, Doomsday.
Hello, let's travel back to Doctor Who's darkest years. Setting coordinates for Dateline, early 1990s. Ready? Hold on tight! What's that, old girl? I see, it's a fixed point in time, so the TARDIS is having difficulty locking onto it. We need something from that period we can use as an anchor. Patsy Caldwell?
Hello, welcome back to...
Boys from the Bush, Paramount City... A packet of Golden Grahams.
Golden Graham!
I know. If we can hitch a ride in on one of those three-dimensional geometric shapes from the Wogan title sequence, we might just make it. Here we go!
So, here we are, early 90s Thatcher's Britain. John Major is the Prime Minister, and these are tough times indeed. In Paisley, a young Stephen Moffat is learning his trade of writing unrealistic female characters on Press Gang. Meanwhile, in Loughborough, for the very first time, Martin Piggins is about to lay down that baseline.
Backstreet bad boys, big time dreams. Solid rocking noise like a killing machine. Born from the flames of a steel porch fire.
And around the UK, fanzine writers are using the phrase Mong with impunity, some several years before comedian Ricky Gervais will be roundly castigated for doing the same. But this is a time bereft of Doctor Who. Within this cultural wasteland, fans gather together. The only means they have of warming themselves is by coming up with their own Doctor Who stories to keep their spirits buoyant. It has to be said that in this period of Earth's history, TV Creamer's Doctor Who storylines we've come up with ourselves, but we don't see why we should share these ideas, for the simple reason impracticality, one, and two, nobody's going to be liable to listen to us. Oh, go on then. We can't remember them in much detail now, but back in the 1990s, we definitely thought the following were viable Doctor Who adventures. Doctor Who and the Invasion of the Schedules with makeover shows. A satirical escapade reflecting the prevailing telly trend of the time. Episode 1 cliffhanger, the Doctor comes face to face with that Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen Queen Anne dining room. 15 to Doomsday. As the Doctor is sucked out into space with only a cricket ball to save him, he has a terrible choice to make. Will he question or nominate? An Unearthly Childs. Through a series of misunderstandings, Doctor Who Colin Baker has to pretend to be the then working lunch presenter.
I've all been scintillating company.
The Macarena Terror. Well, you know, that one writes itself. The storylines other Doctor Who fans came up with gradually began to circulate through original novels and fanzines, and with it came the popularisation of the phrase fanwank, a critical term applied to stories that all too obviously plundered Doctor Who's back catalogue, pairing together monsters and other characters for easy thrills, rather than coming up with original scenarios. The instant gratification of bringing multiple Doctors together or having the Master team up with Morbius
became known as the sort of thing professional Who writers would never do. Fanwank was too insular, too easy, and the people who wrote it were marked out as being just the sort of people who, if the series ever did come back, should be kept as far away from it as possible. Oops, looks like we're off again. Where to now? Stardate 8th of July 2006, Canary Wharf.
You have identified as Daleks.
Outline resembles the inferior species known as Cybermen.
Now this is the moment that Fanwank became Viewerwank. It was obvious all along, really, wasn't it? But this was when we learnt that the secret desires of Doctor Who fans are no different to that of the rest of the audience. Daleks versus Cybermen. What's not to love? And from this point on, Doctor Who has willingly brought us team up after team up.
Of crude cybernetic constructs on worldwide scale.
Sontarans with Silurians, Ood with the TARDIS, the Jadoon with, well, just about everyone, and even Martha Jones with Mickey Smith. To be fair, that one was a bit rubbish.
Setting course for the future now, and it's one that's unconstrained by self-consciousness. Here's hoping for that Master and Morbius team-up. And what about the two Jamies, or the three arms of the Tenth Doctor, or even the four candles of the two Ronnies meets the five Doctors in search of the seven keys to Doomsday versus the eighth deadly sin, which is, of course, as we all know, getting caught.
This is not war, this is pest control!
Number 23. The rare photo of the Rill.
In the days before missing episodes started turning up every 27 seconds, and indeed before fans started unearthing every last paperclip from the 60s Doctor Who production office, there were some costumes, characters, sets, effects, and even monsters where we just didn't have the faintest idea what they would have looked like. Of course, there's still a couple now, from Milo Clancy to the Abbot of Amboise, however you say that, to Lisanne and Roald, however you say them, and even the Desperate Screamer, depending on how well you can make out that one blurry photograph that did turn up from somewhere. But years ago, there were dozens upon dozens upon dozens of them, and it was always something of an event if some credible visual evidence did turn up. One of the most celebrated, if that's the right word, of these missing monsters were the Rills from the 1965 story Galaxy 4.
Tell me, what do these Rills look like?
We had descriptions, yes. We had fans with long memories and hazier recollections. We even had the press report about some of them showing up in an exhibition featuring a Daily Mail-powered train or something. But none of these offered anything any more concrete than that they were wart-encrusted, walrus-like, and, well, that was about it.
They won't show themselves, Doctor.
Who? Why ever not?
In a story where the plot largely hinged around their visual appearance, there were a massive missing piece in an equally missing jigsaw, and the stuff of wild and fervent conjecture. Then one day some bright spark turned up a photo of one.
Yes, it's quite true.
Which was duly printed in Doctor Who magazine with the caption, "The rare photo of the Rill." And then it was printed again, and again, and again, and again, and again, always making great captional capital of its rarity, despite the fact that most fans have probably now seen it more times than they've seen their own passport photo. And anyway, another Rill publicity snapper turned up in the interim. Then an episode of Galaxy 4 actually turned up, opening with a whopping great close-up of a Rill, but still its rarity value remains apparently undiminished. Either that, or everyone's still just copying and pasting everything from everyone else.
Oh, what nonsense, we're not children, you know.
It is best you do not see us.
Everywhere else, carry on, carry on. Get over, I shall ravish you.
Number 22. The Doctor's Office.
Judge not a man by the colour of his tailoring, but by the contents of his character's desk.
That original first draft of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech
were it not a complete tissue of fiction, could have applied superbly to Doctor Who in the 1970s. With a secondment to the British Army's Killing Aliens division that ran for much of the decade, our hero swapped chains of planets for chains of paperclips, and was all the better for it. Doctor Who on the phone in his office was always more entertaining than Doctor Who mediating between testicle-shaped aliens on an intergalactic Pipercraft. Here was the unreal brought down to Earth, literally, and having to cope with the all-too-real. A far more enjoyable ruse than non-stop otherworldliness. So what if his office seemed to change its appearance from story to story? Who doesn't love rearranging their workspace in lieu of anything more constructive on a Friday afternoon? One month a laboratory, the next a garage. If only some of this constructive refashioning could have applied to the Doctor's wardrobe. Nobody wears the same thing to the office 2 days running. Imagine the gossip. Still, moaning about having to go to meetings, being interrupted in the middle of stuff, sitting in a chair with his legs on the desk, this was the Doctor being one of us. And it was superb.
Look, I said I don't want any tea today, thank you.
I'm not the tea lady.
Then what the place is you doing in here? Don't you know this area is strictly out of bounds to everybody except the tea lady and the Brigadier's personal staff?
I'm your new assistant.
Oh, no.
And at number 21, not even a hideous alien monster.
My name is Debbie Flint and I'm a QVC presenter and we work out of studios in Chiswick and I've just come off doing an hour of Women with Control Shape Pants and I'm just about to go back on to do an hour of fashion called Kim & Co.
You faithful ones will doubtlessly know exactly how and when the children's BBC Broom Cupboard alumni turned Shopping Channel Maven's path intersects with a time traveller from Gallifrey. But we're still going to delay that revelation. And so for now, Debbie Flint, we consign you to our Time Scoop Trapezoid!
Shape pants.
Instead, we leave Chiswick to return to 1986. This was a rough period for Doctor Who, with a battle-weary Time Lord languishing in the backwaters of audience popularity.
All my travellings throughout the universe, I have battled against evil. Against power-mad conspirators.
But even while Colin Baker was browbeating Bonnie Langford and Linda, if Barbara Knox-wise, Linda Bellingham, high above planet Earth, a new sanctum for the Doctor was coming into orbit.
A consortium called British Satellite Broadcasting has been awarded the franchise to set up four new television channels. Programmes will be beamed direct to the public via a satellite 22,000 miles above the equator.
3 years on, Doctor Who ambled off terrestrial television, seemingly forever.
Come on, Ace. We've got work to do.
Yeah, mainly unofficial video and audio spin-offs. But as the Doctor himself once famously said,
it's the end.
And it seems on a moment too soon.
And that's because
BSB is here. Our satellite is up. Our tracking station is fully operational.
British Satellite Broadcasting's DMAC, that's not TMAT, imbued quintet of stations began transmitting from the Marco Polo satellite on March 25th, 1990. But for Doctor Who fans, the real Jethric could be found on the network's Galaxy Entertainment channel. alongside reruns of The Goodies, Grange Hill and Murphy Brown, was Doctor Who from the very beginning.
Enjoy the best in science fiction fun with great series like the first Doctor Who every Saturday and Sunday afternoon.
Augmenting this output was a homespun daily entertainment show, 31 West.
We were the one show of the day.
Ah, and here's Debbie, now set free from the time scoop to yak with TV Cream about her stint hosting that proto tea time chat around.
Yeah, 31 West was just probably the best job I've ever had. The co-presenters were Sharma Pereira, who is now still one of my best mates. She'd been on the 6 o'clock show. Simon Potter, who had also been on the children's BBC for a little while with me. And Remy Blumenfeld, who also occasionally co-presented, and he's gone on to be a massive noise in television and production. We arrived at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We had a production meeting, had a nice little cup of tea and a slice of cake some days, went into makeup, looked at the script that someone else had written, met the guests, did a bit of prep, went on air and did half an hour of diverse entertainment.
In September of 1990, 31 West ready to regenerate into something really, really, really exciting.
Transport you through time to the weekend of the 23rd and the 22nd of September, when you will be able to see some of my greatest adventures.
And lo, was born 31 Who, as the magazine show materialised onto Saturday and Sunday for a whole weekend of Doctor Who-related programming.
Well, to be honest, I quite liked Doctor Who. My hero was John Pertwee. Kind of lost touch with it in the Sylvester McCoy era. Ironically, he was the doctor that I ended up interviewing.
And Sylvester, as we dear fans know, can sometimes be a little bit scatterbrained.
If you watch the interview, it was really clear the way we were counting down and everything, but there weren't rehearsals for every single bit that we did. I walked out, did my link, turned to him and asked him a question, and he said,
"Well, do you really want me to tell you right now?"
He thought we were rehearsing. So I think he was perhaps a bit away with the fairies for some of it.
Debbie and her co-host Sharma Pereira were also assigned a third presenter.
Oh no, not Doctor Who. Not even a Time Lord. Not even a hideous alien monster. I'm John Nathan Turner. I'm the former producer of Doctor Who.
Did you notice him stumbling over the word former? But what was it like working with JNT?
John Nathan Turner came across that he was sad that it had ended. Obviously he's no longer with us now. But when he had just sort of stepped out of the fold, as it were, I think he was very glad to be involved in something along the same lines. And I think the only thing we got from him on the day was that he was just very jolly, very easy to work with, and loving every minute of the whole Doctor Who experience for him as it was continuing.
In addition, Debbie had to turn game show host.
Because that was a little bit outside my comfort zone, because I hadn't done anything like that. This was a long time ago, don't forget, so I was still quite a newbie as far as presenting was concerned.
Plus suffer super fan Andrew Beach correcting her enunciation of the Master's block transfer computational creation.
Question 5. What was the Master's TARDIS disguised as in Castrovalva?
Castrovalva, it was a tapestry. No, a fireplace.
Correct. Well, I'll just give you that because you corrected me on my pronunciation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My prep obviously didn't stretch to making sure the pronunciations were right.
Sadly, the weekend was to be a once-only occasion.
Listen, if BSB had continued, I have no doubt whatsoever, with the right funding obviously, Doctor Who would have been one of the big mainstays of the BSB channel. And if everything had carried on and not ended in November because of the merger with Sky, I'm pretty sure they would have had regular Doctor Who weekends and it would have become a massive convention-based event. The first we knew, I think it was about a month before it all wound down, there was talk about it might be merged with Sky. And we weren't sure what would happen to any of us, of course, but we knew really there was such a lot of money being spent on that building. You'd walk into the loos on the ground floor and there were fresh flowers every day. The budgets on our show and the audiences were minuscule. You know, this was a very long-term projection to make money for this company. And obviously, in the cutthroat early days of satellite and cable, there was a lot of changes. It's a real shame because that was an institution for sure. building its name against the embryonic sky that just had a lot of imports and really giving audience what they wanted, because when it went, there wasn't really anything to fill the gap.
In the Donald Pleasance House of Horrors, I'd just like to say that tomorrow you'll wake up to a new look entertainment channel, with the very best of Galaxy combining with the best of Sky's entertainment. Coming to you is Sky One, part of the British Sky Broadcasting Network. So although it's the final goodnight from Galaxy, it's not altogether goodbye. I hope you'll join us as we look to a bright new future. For now, this is Trish Bertram on behalf of everyone here saying thank you for watching. I hope you've enjoyed our company as much as we've enjoyed bringing you Galaxy.
As for Debbie, she became one of the mainstays of the QVC shopping network, despite a brief flirtation with the Ideal World channel in 2000, where she worked alongside presenter Steve Whatley, about whom there really isn't a conspiracy.
It's not a conspiracy against Steve Whatley.
Well, no, I'm just asking. It's just
but just try and keep up a bit yourself.
Oh, I was keeping up. I was ahead of the ball in a lot of
areas. It's not a conspiracy then, Steve.
Bearing that in mind, listening to what you say and my paranoia, I'm the one that's picking up the feeling of I'm third in the fucking pecking order, and I don't like it.
In recent years, Debbie's also turned her talents to novel writing.
Well, through all the shopping telly, through all the being a presenter, I've always thought, when I'm a grown-up, I want to do writing. And I've just spent the last 3 years going on courses and conferences and workshops, and I've ended up writing a steamy romance novel. It's doing rather well. It's self-published on Amazon. It's called Hawaiian Affair. I serialised it, so if someone searches on Amazon for Debbie Flint and finds Hawaiian Affair, there's serialised part one, part two, part three, part four, until I remove it. But the reason I did that was partly to launch it, because I did some freebies, but partly because I wanted to see what the flavour was, what the hunger was for steamy versus PG. So in two of the areas of the book, I've actually written the steamy version, or you can get the PG version. Do you know the ratio? 8-1, steamy to non. 8 times more people want steamy versus PG.
Okay, so let's return Debbie Flint to her designated time and place, specifically her hosting gig on QVC's Kim & Co.
Thanks very much, Adele. You're still over there yapping. You've got me, Debbie Flint, for this 60 minutes. I've been looking forward to this because I absolutely...
And let's also wrap up our look back at BSB's Doctor Who weekend, a weekend that, during the Doctor's darkest hours, proved something of a beacon for the Time Lords fans. So thank you, Debbie. Thank you, Sharma. And thank you, former producer of Doctor Who, John Nathan Turner.
Sadly, our energy banks have nearly lost their power and it's time for us to go. So now, it only remains for us to say...
Exterminate! Exterminate!
The Cybermen hope you enjoyed the podcast. There now follows an abbreviated version of the next audio dispatch from TV Cream.
And you, Mr. Grenville... Has your wife come back from her sister's yet?
I'm Matthew Rudd, host of Forgotten 80s on Absolute 80s.
In at number 10, it's the Game of Wrestle.
I know an old lady who swallowed a fly. I don't know why she swallowed a fly. I guess she'll die.
This cyber unit is now reassigning itself to Canary Wharf, London, to deploy several lines of backchat against that emotive species known as the Daleks.